The last copies of the largest pro-democracy newspaper in Hong Kong are running off the presses tonight as the Apple Daily shuts down.
There are people frantically seeking to download a lot of the videos and content as the hours tick away.
I'm Carol Hills. Afghans are crossing into Iran and then Turkey along a mountain pass on their way to seeking asylum in Europe. We take you to the remote border region.
In the middle of nowhere and no one there, if a wolf comes, we don't have even a knife to defend ourselves.
And wait till you hear what happened in the Netherlands.
We would never do this today. It's just absolutely appalling.
AI is healing an old master. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Apple Daily, Hong Kong's biggest pro-democracy newspaper, announced today it was making its final print run. Supporters gathered outside the paper's office this evening to express their anger.
Do not go gentle! Rage against the dying of the light!
Last week, Hong Kong authorities froze the outlet's bank accounts, raided its offices, and arrested top editors. We caught up with one reporter from the Apple Daily who is packing up his desk after 9 years with the publication. We're not using his name because he fears retaliation from the government. He told me he feels disappointed and sad.
Even when the police raided the Apple Daily last week, the only thing that all of our colleagues thought of was to deliver the news. I hope everyone could understand that this is not just the closure of Apple Daily or a media outlet, because it shows the deterioration of Hong Kong's situation. The freedom of press is gone, it's all gone.
News of the closure sent chills through the ranks of other media outlets on the island. Tom Grundy is editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Hong Kong Free Press. It's an independent English media outlet in Hong Kong.
Well, this 26-year-old pro-democracy daily that has long been a thorn in the side of the authorities is seeing its last print run tonight. The board said that it would be running about a million copies, we understand, tonight in a city of 7 million. The fact is, they do have the money, but they can't pay staff. $2.3 million worth of assets were frozen connected to the parent company. And many of the staff since, so we have learned, have quit. So it seems that already the English news section, the finance section, video department and Twitter account have ceased. And tomorrow's edition will be its last.
So tomorrow is the last paper edition. Is it also the end of any online presence?
Well, we're trying to clarify that tonight, but it looks like the websites will actually be removed. What happens next with regards to whether it will continue covering Hong Kong from its base in Taiwan is very unclear. Same for the archives. There are people frantically seeking to download a lot of the videos and content as the hours tick away.
What is Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam saying about this move and the future for independent reporting on the island?
Well, all along, the authorities have said that press freedom would be preserved under the national security law. On Tuesday, Chief Executive Carrie Lam was asked by Bloomberg to clarify how reporters can avoid arrest. And she said only that journalists should be in a position to decide for themselves if they are breaking the law, because the security law is very clear. But if there's one way it's been described in the last year, it's been unclear, vague. In terms of its wording, the Security Bureau has refused to say whether the 30 articles that have prompted this raid last week on the paper, opinion pieces, editorials, or hard news reporting. And one can understand that the rest of the media would want to know this. Otherwise, we're going to see a chilling effect. But of course, other critics say that the government wants to keep these red lines fuzzy because people may overcompensate to try and navigate them.
Huh. So sort of keep everybody guessing and erring on the side of caution if there's no explanation.
Perhaps. And to be honest, that's often how it works in the mainland. These in mainland China, the rules are not set in stone, but people are expected to be able to navigate things. But, you know, it's quite difficult in what was once probably the freest corner, you know, in Asia, where these things like press freedom, free expression have been enshrined in the mini constitution, the basic law, to adjust at this kind of speed. We talk about whiplash in terms of just how fast some of these civil liberties and rights and guarantees that were under the basic law have come under fire. At the same time, the authorities have been at pains to you know, state that the security law has brought peace and stability to the city after the unrest and protests we saw in 2019. They've said it only affects a small minority of people, and indeed just over 100 have been arrested under the law.
Hong Kong authorities, they seem to have wanted the paper shuttered by July 1st. Why? Why that date?
July 1st marks the handover anniversary when Hong Kong was handed over from Britain and its rights and freedoms were meant to be guaranteed until 2047. It also happens to be a traditional day of protest, but the organizing coalition has cancelled it this year. This is weeks after the Tiananmen massacre, another symbol of free expression and speech and protest in the city, was deemed illegal under COVID restrictions and it not getting permission. So these sort of three pillars, along with Apple Daily, have raised some eyebrows as to what's going on in the city, certainly. As for whether things will continue from Taiwan, the paper certainly is in a robust position there, but it's difficult to know whether they will continue covering Hong Kong from afar, because there's also a question of outsourcing that risk to freelancers and stringers, you know, on the ground here. So it's unclear what's going to happen next with the staff and with the paper itself.
So where do things go from here for press freedom in Hong Kong?
Well, you know, this was always a symbol of press freedom. It was always important that it was in print because it was the last pro-democracy print daily in town. Often the government will place ads on the front pages of the newspapers here, and Apple Daily was always the odd one out that didn't carry, you know, an ad supporting the national security law or celebrating the handover. In fact, the media landscape here is mostly made up of establishment titles that are owned by the Communist Party, owned by business people with interests in the mainland, or owned by Chinese conglomerates like Alibaba. So certainly it's a loss in the print world, but there are a couple other pro-democracy digital news outlets. But of course, a lot of questions over who might be next. Already we've seen the public broadcaster, the equivalent of the BBC, under heavy fire. And as you say, the authorities, there were rumors that they wanted the Apple Daily gone by July 1st. And it seems the last copies are running off the press tonight.
So, Tom, where does that put you and your own outlet, Hong Kong Free Press?
Well, we're not a pro-democracy outlet. We are a non-profit public news service funded by contributions, you know, from readers. Our motto since the security law has just been to keep calm and carry on, hope for the best, prepare for the worst, of course, but otherwise get the news out, basically. But, of course, we would all want some clarity over what exactly these articles are that prompted 500 police to arrest the five top executives, including the editor-in-chief, as well as raid the newsroom last week, because although it's been raided before, this is the first time we have seen a newsroom raid over its content. So we all would like clarity as to what exactly prompted this. In fact, this morning, we saw an opinion writer become the sixth person to be arrested in connection with this Apple Daily crackdown.
Have any of the people who've been detained or arrested, have any of them been let go?
We understand three of them have got bail. One of them has just been arrested, and two of them are still being held. It's unusual to actually get bail under the national security law. In fact, the security law allows for warrantless raids, closed-door court hearings. Judges are hand-selected by the city's leader, and they can even be transferred to the mainland despite these months of unrest over the extradition law. So, you know, as Jimmy Lai, the founder, he's looking at life in prison as this has now gone to a higher court. So I guess along with him, there are now seven people connected to Apple Daily who may be facing these charges under the security law.
Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Hong Kong Free Press. It's an independent English language media outlet in Hong Kong. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
The Black Sea laps up against the shores of both Russia and Ukraine. It's been a hot spot for conflict between the two countries. Today, that tension reportedly spilled over onto a British Royal Navy destroyer. Russia says it fired warning shots toward the British ship after it entered what Moscow considers its territorial waters near Crimea. London, though, says that didn't happen. To untangle this, we contacted Rear Admiral Chris Perry, a former British Royal Navy officer. First of all, remind us of the geography of the Black Sea and where in it this disputed altercation happened.
Well, the Black Sea, of course, is that very large inland sea that you access through the Dardanelles and the Straits by Istanbul at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. On the eastern side of it, you have the former Soviet republics like Georgia. You have Turkey on the southern side, and you have Romania, Bulgaria on the western side, both NATO allies. And of course, to the north, you have both Ukraine and Russia.
The UK, of course, is nowhere near the Black Sea. What was this British Royal Navy vessel, the HMS Defender, doing there in the first place?
HMS Defender is part of a global deployment that is based around our aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth. Now, we know that the Russians are uniquely sensitive about NATO forces in both the Black Sea and the Baltic. But we also know that it's Russia's intention to try and neutralize and isolate our allies in the Baltic and the Black Sea. So as often as we can, we send warships there to demonstrate presence, to basically allow our allies to resist coercion and show the world that we believe in the freedom of navigation.
Now, in this particular incident, Russia says it fired warning shots at the HMS Defender. The UK says this was just a Russian gunnery exercise. What do we know about what actually happened?
Well, what in fact happened, just talking to my colleagues in the Royal Navy, is HMS Defender was transiting on innocent passage between Odessa in the Ukraine and transiting south of Crimea towards its next visit in the country of Georgia, which is on the eastern side of the Black Sea. And now in doing so, it went through Ukrainian territorial seas. The Russians would say it belongs to them, but even if it is Russian, you're still allowed to go on innocent passage through somebody else's territorial seas. So that was entirely the case. It seems that the Russians put two of their border craft in a shadowing position on a destroyer. This is normal. We expect this in the northern part of the Black Sea. I think a couple of their jets came and had a look as well. HMS Defender actually got rather bored with it, so came up in speed. The Russian boats couldn't actually keep up with her, and they sort of fired off their guns in the distance, and Defender went on her way. That's it. What the Russians would like to have you believe is that they saw HMS Defender off the premises, as you would in a nightclub if you didn't rather like somebody in it. It's to say to the world, look, the Royal Navy can't trail its skirts in front of our main naval base. The fact of life is it's legal to do so. Defender did it, and the Russians don't like it very much.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, couldn't moments like this be very dangerous? I mean, for example, if there's a lack of communication, like in this case, couldn't that lead to mistakes and miscalculation?
Absolutely. I think what we have to recognize here, though, the reality on the ground is there was no issue. It's the story and narrative that has been made up by the Russians that is actually creating the tension. And so the British approach is to say, fine, you know, you say what you want to your friends. If it makes you feel good, we're not buying that. We're just moving on. Nothing to see here.
Finally, from your many years of experience in the British Royal Navy, have you ever been on a vessel when an adversary or rival is trying to kind of puff its chest and intimidate you in the ship you're in?
Well, Carol, I mean, I'm old enough to have served in the Cold War, and this was daily rations for both the US Navy and the Royal Navy all the time. I mean, we shadowed every Soviet unit that deployed out of its home base. And indeed, I remember accompanying the USS California, which is a nuclear cruiser, into the Black Sea. And we were basically playing bumper rides with some Russian ships who were trying to keep us out of their territorial waters. So they were coming in close and trying to bump us out. This has happened throughout history, and it looks like we're back in that game again now.
But when you're on that ship in those circumstances, are you nervous or just like, well, this is just another episode of bumper cars?
Well, it's another day in the office, isn't it? With a bit of attitude. No. I mean, the key thing is to control the situation and make sure you understand what is known as the rules of engagement and also what the legal basis for what you're doing is.
Rear Admiral Chris Perry is a former British Royal Navy officer. He's been talking with us about recent tension between the UK and Russia in the Black Sea. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, Carol.
Coming up, a look at what experts fear may be a tipping point in Venezuela. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The numbers are staggering. Since 2015, an estimated 5.5 million Venezuelans have left their country. It's the largest migration from a single country in the region's history. And the numbers are only growing. Humanitarian groups are concerned that the situation is reaching a tipping point. Domenica Arsenyuk is one of them. She's the Colombia country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Domenica, what does a tipping point mean in Venezuela?
A tipping point in Venezuela is basically a combination of factors. It is the largest migration crisis in Venezuela, but it's also the world's second largest crisis. Still, the borders are officially closed, but people continue crossing the borders through whatever means they can. And because they are desperate, they continue leaving and searching for better opportunities in other countries of Latin America that are themselves in a very difficult situation. You may know that Latin America is currently continuing to go through a strong wave of COVID. As the worldwide the cases are decreasing, in Latin America they are increasing. So the people of Latin America are themselves stretched, and the countries receiving Venezuelans are in a difficult economic situation and public health situation. And then on top of that, you have migrants and refugees arriving.
You said this was the second largest migrant crisis. I assume the first one you're speaking of is Syria.
Correct.
Are there tools and money and funding that they have in terms of dealing with that crisis that the countries of Latin America don't have?
Correct. It is quite difficult for the humanitarian sector and humanitarian organizations to attract funding in Latin America compared to other crises in the world, such as Syria. There is simply more aid going to crises in Asia and in Africa rather than in Latin America. As of June, only 8 out of every $100 requested by civil society organizations had been received and reported. So we are still missing core funding to be able to provide basic humanitarian assistance.
The core funding you're talking about, is that money that's been promised from different governments or international organizations that hasn't been received?
Last week we had the International Donors Conference in solidarity with Venezuelan refugees and migrants, which was hosted by Canada, and which was a great achievement of the international community. In the course of this conference, donors pledged in total $1.5 billion. So if the money that was pledged last week is delivered, then obviously we would be in a much better situation. However, in the history of these conferences, usually it is difficult then to register this funding and put it in the pot for the humanitarian organization. So at this stage, we plead to the donors to actually deliver on the pledges that they have done.
Are you concerned that there's going to be a long-term or permanent impact on the region of this huge movement of people?
Well, yes, of course. This is a displacement that started 5 years ago, and so it is already having long-term impact on Latin America in general, right? So if you have 5 million people moving across countries, obviously it is already having impact. That simply the countries that are hosting this population are not able to meet. But what actually this crisis requires are longer-term solutions and longer-term planning to integrate this population in their countries.
Domenica Arsenyuk is the Colombia Country Director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Thanks, Domenica.
Thank you.
Maybe this has happened to you. You move homes or apartments, and the art that fit just perfectly in your old place is too big for your new one. That was the case when a new piece of art was moved to the Amsterdam Town Hall in 1715. But the painting in question was a Rembrandt, and when it wouldn't fit on a wall between two doors, it was cut to fit. Now a team of curators and scientists have recreated the original painting, including its missing cut edge. Robert Erdman is a senior scientist at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. First, the painting is called Night Watch. Can you describe it? What does it depict?
The Night Watch was painted in 1642, and it's a civic guard painting. So it depicts a number of musketeers and a leader of the company, Frans Bonnenkoek, and the company is being led out as if they're beginning a campaign to step off of the painting and towards the left side of the painting.
Was the painting trimmed just because it didn't fit on the wall someone wanted it to?
It was in this Cloveniersdoule, that was basically a meeting hall for these civic guard companies. And then it was moved in 1715 to a smaller room in the Amsterdam City Hall. And the two doors between which it was going to be placed were closer together than the width of the painting. The top, bottom, left, and right were all cut down so that it would fit between the two doors.
And was Rembrandt, you know, as lauded and respected at the time, or was it kind of, you know, Rembrandt, Rembrandt, we're going to trim it to fit the door?
It's not uncommon, believe it or not, to find old master paintings that have been cut because they were, you know, moving to a new house and they wanted it to look nice on the mantle and it was a bit too wide, so they just cut off the left or the right. We would never do this today. It's just absolutely appalling to think about doing this for a Rembrandt today. But in those days, it was not so unusual.
So how do we know what the cut piece was supposed to look like?
In this case, we're quite fortunate because we believe that the main figure in the Night Watch was so happy with it that he commissioned a small copy from a second artist named Gerrit Lundens. This is a 1/5 scale copy, and the copy was made before the pieces were cut off. He did it in his own style and different pigments and so on, so it's not a perfectly faithful copy, but we can use this as a guide for reconstructing what the missing parts looked like.
I gather Rijksmuseum staff used artificial intelligence to reconstruct that cut edge. Can you explain how that works?
The simple thing to do would be to take this small copy, the Lundens copy, and just blow it up. But if you do that, you'll find that the geometry is not quite right, so figures aren't lining up perfectly. The scale and style is a second problem, and the color palette being different between the two is a third problem. So to solve these problems, I designed a series of three artificial neural networks to help us write computer algorithms that allow a computer to understand images much better. This series of algorithms would then allow us to translate from the copy's scale and style and palette into a scale, style, and palette that's like Rembrandt.
So what's it like for you to see the painting as Rembrandt intended it?
Rembrandt has a mastery of composition that is unparalleled, I think. So the figures that were originally not in the center became in the center when the pieces were cut off. And this somehow strips the painting of some sense of movement and purpose. So to really see the painting with the extra part added to the left side and to then feel that the figures are walking out towards us really, for me, changed the way I think of the painting entirely. It was really moving, to be honest.
Robert Erdman is a senior scientist at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Thanks a lot, Robert.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. After 18 years at the Guantanamo detention camp, the so-called Osama bin Laden of Southeast Asia gets his day in court this summer. His lawyer says his case has become a symbol.
A symbol of the fact that America can no longer claim the moral or ethical high ground. We're no better than Russia or China or Iran.
That's up next on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Just 4 months after the September 11th attacks in 2001, prisoners in orange jumpsuits were marched into cells at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp. Some of them are still there. One of the detention camp's most notorious inmates will soon stand trial 18 years after he was captured. But as The World's Patrick Wynn reports, this case is still haunted by the CIA's ruthless treatment of terrorism suspects.
They called it the sequel to 9/11. Not long after the 9/11 attacks, al-Qaeda supposedly links up with Southeast Asian terrorists, and together they plot to hijack another jet and fly it into a skyscraper, this time in L.A. But the CIA caught them first and made them squeal. So claimed the George W. Bush White House, like Bush speechwriter Mark Thiessen, who went on Fox News waving so-called al-Qaeda confession papers. This is proof, he said.
Proof that this terrorist program, that this terrorist surveillance interrogation program stopped the next 9/11.
Enhanced interrogation, CIA black sites, and torture. The Bush administration said that's what it took to get al-Qaeda leaders to reveal this plot with this cell in Southeast Asia.
Who were planning to hijack a plane and fly it into the Library Tower in Los Angeles. And if it had not been for this program, there would be a hole in the ground in Los Angeles to match the one in New York City.
The alleged mastermind of this plot is Hambali, just one name, a man from Indonesia, a former kebab seller turned radical. And when Hambali was caught in 2003, they called him the Osama bin Laden of Southeast Asia. President Bush claimed he was one of the world's most lethal terrorists.
George Bush said a lot of really, really fantastically stupid things over his 8 years as president. This might have been one of the bigger ones.
That is James Hodes, attorney for Hambali, who is now being readied for a trial after nearly 18 years. But the torture inflicted on Hambali by CIA agents is so revolting that the CIA should be on trial. That's what Hambali's lawyers say. Hodes says this whole saga, it is a symbol.
A symbol of the fact that America can no longer claim the moral or ethical high ground. We're no better than Russia or China or Iran.
Hodes works for the Defense Department. He's part of a two-person legal team assigned to represent Hambali. The other lawyer is Marine Corps Major James Valentine.
I'm a Marine Corps officer. I've taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. There's been no greater breach of our own values and morals than what happened in Guantanamo and what's happened as part of the CIA's torture experiment.
It is common knowledge that the Bush administration, after 9/11, did invent evidence. So I wanted to know whether Hambali really is this arch villain, as they first alleged. The prosecution declined to talk to me, but they have given him the rap sheet from hell. Victims fleeing the Bali bombing in 2002, when more than 200 people, mostly tourists, were killed on that Indonesian party island. The U.S. says Hambali was behind that. And a smaller bombing against a Marriott hotel in Indonesia. And, of course, the 9/11-style plot against L.A. Hambali's attorneys say it's pretty much all untrue. So I asked James Hodes, okay, who was Hambali?
I think he was a person who cared very much about his faith, and I believe he wanted others to care about his faith the way he did.
Well, that is one way to put it. Hambali was high up in Jamaa Islamiya, a jihadi group hoping to start an Islamic state in Southeast Asia. And they did carry out that Bali bombing, no doubt about it. Only at that point, Hambali's attorneys say he was not calling the shots. Seeking a source not connected to this case, I talked to counterterrorism expert Dr. Ahmad El-Mohammadi in Malaysia and asked him about that Bin Laden of Southeast Asia label. He said, well, if we say that...
Yeah, we make a tiger out of a cat. That's the way I see it.
A tiger out of a cat. But still, this cat, if he was talking to Al-Qaeda, maybe taking money from them, that would make him a target. A target in what Bush called a great manhunt that was...
going after the remaining killers who hide in cities and caves, and one by one, we will bring these terrorists to justice.
That is the U.S. Congress applauding in 2004. Back then, anyone with an Al-Qaeda affiliation, Dr. El-Mohammadi says, was a sitting duck.
The U.S. government still interested because of the affiliation and also because of the information that they can glean from the interrogation.
The interrogation. That is where Major Valentine says the U.S. made a fateful choice, to take detainees, send them through a series of CIA black sites, and torture them for information.
They chose the path of the dark side. They cannot have it both ways. They can't both operate on the dark side and then pretend to wash their hands of all of that and proceed according to customary international standards and the rule of law.
I asked him, the torture of Hambali, how bad was it?
I'm not allowed to tell you anything because I am bound by the security agreement.
Best he could do was point to a report by the Senate on CIA torture in the War on Terror. It describes force-feeding prisoners anally, inmates nearly dying from waterboarding, and keeping people awake for nearly a week. James Hodes, Hambali's other lawyer, told me, dig in that report and you'll find a disturbing quote.
A CIA agent saying to Hambali, "The world can never know what we did to you here." And that's in the report. And that one actually made it past the censors. Don't know how, but it did.
There is the crux of it, he says. Why turn a cat into a tiger? Because when you torture someone that badly, you better have a good reason. Like he was plotting another 9/11, even if it's not entirely true. This also might explain why this case and others at Guantanamo take so long to get to trial. Because what president, Democrat or Republican, wants all this to get aired out?
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks.
And yet, President Barack Obama also gave full immunity to the CIA agents who carried out the torture. As for Hambali, his case is advancing now, but slowly. Attorney James HOTUS has no clue when it will really get going.
We have no idea. Everything is very fluid at this organization, Patrick, and in this military commission, because I really can't refer to it as a trial.
A man described as one of the world's most lethal terrorists, and yet the American justice system seems in no hurry to give him his day in court. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
It's been nearly 10 years since the fall of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Since then, Libyans have faced civil war, humanitarian crisis, and an economic downturn. Today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with world leaders in Berlin to discuss the country's future. Libyan political analyst Mohamed Aljar has been following the conference. He's speaking to us from a restaurant in Tunis, in Tunisia. Mohamed, can you tell us what was discussed at this conference and what's come out of it so far?
Well, the Berlin 2 conference is a follow-up to the Berlin 1 conference that took place in January 2020 last year. And the idea of the Berlin conference is an attempt to try and bring international stakeholders with stake in Libya around one table in order to agree on a common agenda. Namely, today there has been huge emphasis on two key files, and that is elections on the 24th of December this year, and then the issue of foreign mercenaries and forces that are operating in Libya.
But has anything come out of the conference so far on any of those topics?
Yes, there has been a joint communique, if you like, of 51 points, if you like, dealing with various files and issues. And it achieved what it's supposed to achieve, an agreement between those internationals and a commitment between those internationals with stake in Libya to try and support and push for the stability in Libya. However, this by no means means that we will indeed end up delivering on the 51 points that have been agreed in the joint communique.
Libya's interim government was present at the meeting. Who are they and who do they represent?
Currently, Libya, at least on paper, has one unified government. It's called the Government of National Unity. It was formed as a result of the political process under the auspices of the United Nations. However, this government remains fractured from within, given that it's the nature of unity governments.
How much is the international community relying on this interim government to bring stability and security to Libya?
Well, this interim government, according to the political roadmap that was agreed by the Libyan Political Forum under the auspices of the United Nations, has a very clear task, which is to unify state institutions that have been divided since 2014 and to prepare the environment for elections to take place on the 24th of December. And thirdly, to improve services and livelihoods. These are the tasks of this government. But indeed, it's important to have a unified government that the world can deal with in order to support this process, the process of elections and the process of starting at least or planning for the removal of foreign forces and mercenaries.
Libya's civilians have had a really tough time over the past decade. In brief, what are the main challenges they currently face in terms of displacement and lack of civilian services and infrastructure?
I mean, since the agreement on this unity government, there hasn't been fighting, which is good news for many Libyans, which means that we don't have any active displacement anymore. But overall, because of years of conflict, the services in the country have deteriorated significantly. Security has also deteriorated significantly. There has been a crippling cash crisis in the country. The value of the dinar has dropped significantly. So all in all, the situation remains dire. But compared to 2019 and the beginning of 2020, there was a war. So compared to the war, the situation is now a little bit better.
I read that a main coastal highway in Libya, the east-west coastal highway, is now reopened. How significant is that?
Well, it was announced, reopened by the Prime Minister, Dbeibe, who was present in Berlin today. But his announcement was premature. And immediately after the announcement by the Prime Minister, who was hoping to score a political gain ahead of the Berlin conference, the 5+5 Joint Military Committee decided that the road should remain closed until few issues technical issues, if you like, are resolved first and put in order first. So the road is not open yet, but it's important that the road is reopened because it would make the lives of ordinary citizens to move between east and west much easier, and it would save them a lot of time.
Mohamed Aljar is a Libyan political analyst and researcher. We reached him in Tunisia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This month marks 9 years since many young undocumented men and women first got some relief from deportation through a program called DACA. That stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's helped hundreds of thousands of people, mostly from Mexico, but also from other parts of Latin America, Asia, and Africa. The World's Daisy Contreras has the story of how DACA has affected two people across two generations of the program.
Carla Mercado was 11 years old when she saw President Barack Obama on TV announce DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It was 2012.
Effective immediately, the Department of Homeland Security is taking steps to lift the shadow of deportation from these young people. Over the next few months...
That was 9 years ago. DACA would give thousands of undocumented young people temporary protection from deportation and a work permit, renewable every 2 years. Mercado is a newcomer to the program, or at least she hopes to be. She just applied for DACA this year. She's been undocumented since she was 2 when she came to the U.S. with her parents from Bolivia. As a kid, she didn't really know what DACA meant.
We didn't really pay it too much attention because I wasn't eligible for it yet. So we just kind of kept waiting.
Now she finally is. Mercado is 19, a pre-med student, and lives in Virginia with her parents. She's part of a new generation of undocumented people who qualified for DACA during the Trump administration, which fought against DACA. Nothing seemed certain. At first, Mercado held up from applying.
Out of fear, with the Trump administration coming in for the first time and immediately going into different policies attacking our community, there was the concern that maybe applying for DACA would actually put me at greater risk.
But she waited too long. The Trump administration ended DACA just before she wanted to apply. Trump officials said the program had been unlawfully put into place. Mercado says she sometimes questions why she waited.
After the program was rescinded, I thought to myself, maybe I should have taken the risk. Maybe I should have put in my application. Where would I be now?
So Mercado remained undocumented throughout high school, without much to look forward to. She couldn't get a driver's license, a work permit, or financial aid for college. She felt lost, she says.
It's definitely something more unique having to go through those pivotal moments in life, coming of age, without a protection like DACA to help through some moments that seem basic, the basic milestones.
Jose Munoz has been there, but he belongs to a much older generation of DACA recipients, part of the first group who applied for it under Obama. He was in his 20s back then.
It wasn't until I was able to apply for DACA that I was able to get some more financial aid, apply for a job that paid for some of my schooling, which was really a game changer.
Munoz is also with United We Dream, a national group led by immigrant youth. He says that while Mercado's generation and his generation do have many things in common, he also sees the differences. Today, there's more awareness about what it means to be undocumented.
In some ways, it's easier for people to find community and to find the resources that they need to be able to navigate life as an undocumented person, even anything as simple as like resources for college or things like that.
Carla Mercado has found that community with other undocumented students. During the pandemic, she joined virtual gatherings that made those connections easier. She's participated in rallies demanding that Congress provide a pathway to citizenship for undocumented people. But she's still looking for something to arrive in the mail. After several years of waiting, people can now apply for DACA again. Mercado submitted her application and is waiting for a response. It's a tough wait, she says. One filled with excitement, but also anxiety.
And sometimes I'll think about it and feel like years have passed and it's been forever. Why are they taking so long? And then other times I'll really stop and be like, okay, it's only been a couple months. You know, they're still doing their thing.
There's uncertainty, though. Although the Biden administration says it supports DACA, the program still has its enemies. Texas is suing to end DACA, Among other things, it argues that a president doesn't have the power to create a program like it. It's overreach, they say. It's another legal battle that puts the program in jeopardy. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Witnesses in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region said dozens of people were killed today, allegedly after an air raid on a busy marketplace. It's the latest violence in a conflict we've been reporting on since it began last November. Read more about today's developments in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. For people from Afghanistan trying to reach Europe to seek asylum, crossing the mountains between Iran and eastern Turkey is a popular route. Now, escalating violence and a looming U.S. military retreat is stoking fears that the Taliban will tighten its grip on Afghanistan. And the pandemic has already tightened border controls all along migration routes. Duri Buskaran traveled to eastern Turkey to report on conditions at the mountain crossing for Afghan travelers.
In a small park behind a bus station, a 19-year-old named Sami sits with his elderly mother. Though Afghans have a right to request asylum in Turkey, this traveling party did cross the border without permission. That's why we aren't using his full name.
The main reason is it's war. You go to bazaar, there is bomb explosions. You walk on the street, there is bomb explosions. You never know. And the other reason is there is no work. The life is there very difficult.
Sami speaks Turkish fluently. He came here on his own 5 years ago, was granted asylum, and went to school. But Sami found out recently that his father passed away, leaving his elderly mother widowed and alone in Kunduz, a city in the north of Afghanistan. He decided to go back for her. I don't know whether to laugh or cry, she says. As Sami tells it, the pair secured visas to Iran. Then they paid a smuggler to take them to Turkey through the Zagros Mountains, a steep range of snow-capped peaks that rival the size of the American Rockies. When they reached Turkey, they were stopped by police, fed a hot meal, and deported back to the Iranian side of the border. They decided to try again, crawling past the patrol checkpoints on their hands and knees. Sami says it took 8 hours.
So slow, my mom. Every time I had to ask our friends at the front, please slow. And they say, in the middle of nowhere and no one there, if a wolf comes, we don't have even a knife to defend ourselves.
Finally, when they reached the eastern Turkish city of Van, they were told to wait for a car that would take them the rest of the way. Sami and his mother are going to a city in western Turkey, where his brothers live. Here at the bus station, they wait with a young couple from Logar province, also in Afghanistan. A baby sleeps in the shade, swaddled in a blanket, while their older kids run around the park. He's 26, and he was a fruit seller back in Logar. He says he was routinely threatened by the Taliban. They'd ask for money, say they'd take the kids. He and his wife knew their sons would be required to attend religious schools if the Taliban took control, and their daughter would be forbidden from attending school at all. I want my daughter to go to school and become a doctor, his wife adds.
It is not illegal to seek asylum and safety.
Babur Balok is a spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR.
Wherever these desperate arrive at a border point, the best thing to do is to provide these desperate people access to asylum, to take them through a process so they don't end up being abused by traffickers, smugglers, or dying in the sea.
Balok says it's hard to know how the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan will change things. There are already 3 million Afghans who are refugees within their own country. If a peace process between the Afghan government and the Taliban doesn't work out, they may be forced to leave. But the countries they flee to are stepping up migration controls. The Turkish government has arrested 49,000 people in the past 6 months, according to the Directorate General of Migration Management. And many people who do make it choose not to seek asylum here because they hope to do it in Europe. As people who migrate try to avoid police, they start to take bigger and bigger risks, like crossing Van Lake, a massive interior lake in eastern Turkey that sits between the mountainous border region and the cities where it's a little easier for people to move around without the threat of deportation.
In order to skip those checkpoints, they use one leg.
Mehmet Kaçan, an attorney at the Van Bahr Association, takes me to a municipal graveyard far in the back, where a small field of simple slabs is the final resting place for people who have died far from their homes.
He died in one lake last year, 26th of June of 2020. And if you see, they put Y and G, Vangölü, it means, and they give the number 20, number 20.
A year ago this week, a boat carrying migrants across Lake Van capsized, killing 61 people. Only the driver of the boat survived after swimming to shore. On Kaçan's phone are videos he's received from the victims' families. One appears to have been taken from below decks before the boat sank. It's now being used as evidence in court. Dozens of young men are packed in the hold. Some sit down, looking seasick. Others are laughing and joking to themselves.
It's like they're so young.
Yeah, mostly youngsters and teenagers.
That same year, 23 people froze to death while crossing the mountains. There have been fewer deaths so far this year, Kaçan says, but European borders are starting to open again. He thinks the number will rise. I worry about the families at the bus station, whether the smuggler they hired will take them to safety or steal their money and leave them on the side of the road. But the next day, I get a message from Sami. We made it to the city, he writes. Everything is fine. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Van, Turkey.
Russia is famously cold. In the 1920s, the town of Oymyakon hit a record low. Today, there's even a placard commemorating the temperature, which Oxford fellow Nick Middleton pointed out in a CBS special recently.
This is the temperature, minus 71.2. That's the coldest ever recorded in an inhabited town.
Today, a heat wave is gripping Russia. Moscow today saw its hottest June day on record. The mid-afternoon temperature of 95 degrees Fahrenheit edged out the previous record set in 1901.
Солнце яркое такое, и как-то, ну, как со всех сторон просто обогревает. Я чувствую уже, начинаю гореть со всех сторон.
This is a tourist in Russia named Anton Muchnev telling Reuters that the heat from the sun is really strong. He feels like he's starting to get sunburned. So what's an overheated Russian to do? Head to a so-called permafrost park to cool off, like this one in the remote region of Yakutia in northern Siberia. That's the sound of tourists making snowballs from permafrost at the Glacial Valley Park, taking selfies and having fun in the melting snow. Nice to cool off in, not so nice for the planet. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.